Okay, we're joined here today with a very special person on a very special podcast. We're joined with Chuck from the Young Patriots Party. Chuck was part of a group that in the 60s, along with the Black Panthers and other organizations, formed the original Rainbow Coalition. Not the Rainbow Coalition to be confused with Jesse Jackson, but an amalgamation of class struggle groups that were comprised of different nationalities that were organizing around class issues in the areas they lived in. And the Young Patriots was a group of Southern working class white people that were part of a community that had moved up from the South that were based primarily in Chicago. And we're going to be talking about just the history of the Young Patriots, the kind of organizing that they did, and kind of how the Young Patriots can shine a light on contemporary organizing, especially in white working class communities. And we're going to talk a little bit about Trump. We're going to talk about the white working class. We're going to talk about organizing. We're going to talk about organizing across racial lines. But moreover, this is the start of a conversation on this podcast, moreover, about the white working class and kind of the coming terrain that we find ourselves in with Trump, with rising white nationalism, and just the kind of the battles ahead. So, Chuck, I wondered if you could just open this up and talk a little bit about what it was like when you grew up and kind of what propelled you into political organizing.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on, and good morning, everybody. I grew up in this area of eastern Washington. I was born in Kansas, but during World War II, my mother got work out here in Hanford at the nuclear plant that built the bomb off of Nagasaki. So she later bought a house in a little place that was east of Spokane near the Idaho border. That's where I grew up from 1947. Until 1959. I was a farm kid. It's all a rural area. I was working on a combine when I was 10 years old. By the time I was a teenager, I was working in a local slaughterhouse business. So I had money, but I was into a pretty nasty kind of work for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I got married at age 17, started having children then, not necessarily out of choice, but just because we didn't know what we were doing. In terms of sex, and so I just kept working. I've been a hardworking person quite a bit of my life from early on, and I've managed to keep working and raise my family and get a four-year degree from Eastern Washington State College near Spokane in Cheney. It's now called Eastern Washington University. From there, oh, and I should add that in school there, they required men, males only in the first 2 years to take a reserve officer training program in the United States Army, ROTC. And so I got early mandatory training, did very well as a military student, and really didn't have any ideas exactly then that I got later. But that's for later a little bit, because I then got a scholarship to go into graduate work in a doctoral program at the University of Oregon in 1965. And I moved my wife and two children to Eugene and began studies there. That was a big move away from very conservative Eastern Washington. This is Trump land. This is a lot of, Spokane is considered like a kind of an overgrown cowboy town to many people, about 300, 250,000 people. So Eugene, Oregon was then full of ferment from the Bay Area, and it was a place where white kids like me, I never met a person color until I was 20 years old. Everybody around me was white. So by the time I get to Eugene, I'm around folks, and at that point, beginning to come in from larger urban areas because of the rebellion, primarily. There was a lot of money thrown in to bring students in from Watts and other black communities, and in the West in particular, from Oregon. So I'm coming into a time when there's a lot of stuff going on. And I study hard. I'm a really good student. I got a full ride the first year in my studies. My marriage fell apart. And I began to think about things differently. I'm meeting African students and African American students. And all of a sudden, I'm a pretty good sociologist, but I've never read much of Karl Marx because he's only a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
In most sociology classes, and I began to hear about Franz Fanon and Quavian, and of course soil reclaimer and so on. But I went through a major change in my personal life, and I ended up remarrying an African American woman with three children, and I kept my two children because my first wife was pretty much done with raising children shortly. So in Eugene, Oregon, in 1967 on up through 1969, we were one of the first interracial families walking around Eugene streets in a place where some of your folks may know and that Oregon has a long history of right-wing small-town groups.
Yeah.
Astoria and Roseburg and towns south of Eugene, and some of them have been in the news recently. One of the mass shootings took place in the Upper area. Anyway, the it was a totally different experience for me personally, and I began to get a new sense that maybe I didn't want to do this graduate school work anymore, and my wife was educating me about the sundown laws and you know, in southern Oregon towns and how, you know, I'm seeing things altogether different. And that included going through the period of Martin Luther King's assassination, and beginning little by little, I had a black mentor, John Howard, was leading me into the studies. I have a mathematics background, so I was a so-called mathematical sociologist. If you can get your hand, you know, grasp that one, that's a somewhat contradiction. But anyway, I was good at it, and I knew how to do numbers, and I began to study census data. I just got into the numbers about what's going down in the cities that Oregon was primarily a white campus. I'm a white person. I'm learning this stuff too. And next thing you know, we decide after, especially Dr. King's murder, that there's, you know, something else had to happen, and my wife was crawling along with me. There wasn't much on campus back then that attracted a couple like us, because the black student groups weren't necessarily, they didn't necessarily have a class analysis of what was going down. They had a more of an identity, civil rights notion, even back to Africa, cultural nationalist now. So that didn't make it much room for either my wife or I exactly. So that's how we ended up going to 1969 and to attend the United Front Against Fascism conference, all by the Black Panther Party. And that's where, among other people I met Bill Preacher Man Festival. Came from back east, from Chicago, to tell us about the Young Patriots. And I sat there in that audience and I thought, shit, man, that is me. That is me. I'm not a hillbilly. I'm a flatlander. I'm a Kansan. But I'm a working class white dude all the way. I just happen to be in the university at that time.
Right.
Anytime, you've got questions.
I was just gonna say, can you just kind of explain first the conference against fascism that occurred, that was called by the Panthers, but moreover, just kind of give listeners an overview of who were the Young Patriots, what was their story, where did they come out of, and kind of like how did they get started?
All right, very good. I heard about the Young Patriots at this particular conference, which invited all people from different communities, the brown communities, the red communities, to come and speak about revolution. And that's where I first heard Bill Festman, or Preacher Man, as he was called. He formed with others in uptown Chicago at night, and they grew out of street gangs. They grew out of gangs that evolved in their understanding of where they were in their community and the kinds of conditions that they were facing, including lots of housing issues and battles with the police, because the white hillbillies weren't any more treated any better in uptown Chicago than other portions of that huge city and black and brown communities. And by 1969, these street gangs had developed with the help of some of the students for Democratic Society, who went into the communities and began teaching somewhat the strategies kinds of ways that this man was able to reach across lines and even defy in some of his own members to say, we're going to work with these white hillbillies.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they did. And your viewers may or may not know, there's an excellent documentary called American Revolution 2 that is available online or in the Young Patriots But it's well worth watching. It also featured in the Panthers' latest documentary, Vanguard of the Revolution. You can see some of those old folks standing up there saying, if they'll stand with me, I'll stand with them. And that's really what happened. I just thought, this is perfect. I can imitate this and out here. I can set up a chapter on my own. And I talked to the preacher man I went back to Eugene and went to work in the community. The Panther chapter was already going, and so we worked alongside the Panther chapter in Eugene, Oregon, serving free breakfast for children. We had programs for free clothing and free food. We cut firewood in the mountains outside of Eugene, mountainous area. Eugene wasn't very big then. We did other things, whatever the people needed then, to basic needs, and had our own information then. Well, essentially, it didn't take long before the very noticeable Panthers in their black clothing and their marching up and down the Eugene streets to get the cops pretty uptight. And it escalated pretty fast. And from the initial context, the police put on the Panther chapter. Didn't take long before it spilled in over into our community information center in another neighborhood. Eugene is primarily white. There weren't very many local black folks. The energy was coming from the campus primarily, among students who were raised in Watts. The two Panther leaders in Eugene had been raised in Watts, and they were tough young brothers. And I learned from them. We all did red book classes together, and we worked together pretty close, man, pretty close. And what led to next was somebody that we were never able to identify or much beyond seeing who they were. A guy in a pickup started stalking black and white members of our two parties, and at one point stuck a rifle out the window of his pickup right near the campus, pointed it toward one of our white women, kind of skinny, and called her a goddamn nigger-loving bitch. And he fired a shot at her, and she ran pretty fast. And we called a press conference. We began carrying arms. I'd grown up with firearms. It was never too much of a problem to me. I can't say we were not scared about this. We had children. We sandbagged our house. We put plywood up on the windows. And we got ready for more. But really, what was happening is that we were being eroded by COINTELPRO in the region. And so a man named Ed Atkins, who eventually took the stand against me in federal court, he was in the neighborhood, and I now believe that that's the man who essentially set up what happened next. I picked up with my wife at night, two patriots coming from New York City to work with us in Eugene. And as we drove into Eugene, I got a Eugene police officer pulled us over, and I was wearing a .45 then. There were guns in the trunk, including a sawed-off shotgun, 1/4 inch shorter than law allows. And so what happened is that was confiscated, and this gets kind of tangled to me because I went back to New York City for a while, and they busted the rest of us patriots after this initial Eugene stop, and they busted the entire chapter in New York City. Now see, what had happened is that the patriots had split too. I just found this out in the last 2 or 3 years from my thermal. The patriots had split, and some of the preacher man and a couple other members decided they wanted to carry this energy of uptown Chicago in a national direction. They were also okay with using the Confederate flag, which, as I understand, some of the uptown patriots were not.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was some reasonable understanding. that wasn't even something that troubled me much, but what was mostly on my mind is that I think, and I did, the Young Patriots, because I knew that growing up in my own white community, we had the same problems, just like Pye Thurman did, and the others in Uptown did. It seemed to be losing a real case. We're so good. Anyway, I'm enjoying this conversation. But what happened is that I got busted, and I went to trial in Portland Federal Court in 1970, and the police officer who had pulled us over that dark night, he testified in full Marine Corps uniform on the witness stand against me, and the jury convicted me of constructive possession of an illegal firearm. No one else, five other people in the car, including my wife, who was the African-American woman, no one else was charged or tried. But I was picked out, apparently, to be the one to fall for this as the defense captain of the Patriot Party. And the federal court in Portland gave me 10 years. I had no priors. Gave me a 10-year sentence, and I was sent to McNeil Island in 1978. I tried to make bail. I filed in federal court, and they wouldn't let me out on appeal because they said it was a danger to the community. A former housemate named Richard Olva testified against me to save his own ass, and so did one of the Panthers, Artie Cox. To deny bail and say yes, in fact, Chuck was a danger, and we did talk about doing things that we shouldn't have. And it's,
oh my God,
it's all coming out of my record. It's about dynamitings and stuff that never amounted to anything other than them talking about me to save themselves, because back then you could take the stand and say, I'm not going to take the Fifth Amendment in 1970 when this happened, but a new law was called qualified immunity use, something of that sort, that came out in the new COINTELPRO legislation that allowed judges to say to a witness who wouldn't want to talk about me in this case, my two former comrades are faced with the issue of, are you going to name Chuck, are you going to talk about him? Don't you go to jail indefinitely? Under the law at that time, it was a case of you're held in contempt of court, and sure enough, that's what happened. So I was in McNeil for quite a while. There was a lot of killings going on, a lot of violence, and I started learning some jailhouse law from an old timer. I was a pretty rare dude in there, man. College education, white, and rebels, Young Patriots. What's that? But it worked out good, because people were definitely learning. 1970, as folks may know, was a pretty hot year in prisons around the country. By 1971 is when Attica Avenue was all that time, it was going down in prison in the same for McNeil Island. And so we filed a major class action lawsuit against the administration. We accused them of genocide. That led to a major work strike, the first work strike in McNeil's 96-year history. It was one of the most interesting nonviolent massive unity events I've ever been in. About 1,000 men wouldn't go to work, and at that time McNeil was producing special cables for Polaris submarines as part of the prison industry's work. And so that shut down some of the military industrial complex for a short time, about 10 days until they busted the strike. And they moved me to Marion. I was held in a hole in segregation for many months, and then they shipped me out at night with one of the men who had killed another man in there. It was a pretty bad dude.
Mm-hmm.
And we rode a little small plane all the way to Marion, and I ended up being at Marion during the time that Attica happened. I wasn't there very long, but they had a lot of community support, and I was a first timer. My 10 years was nothing in Marion. There, double life plus 500 years. Get out of here, man. Nobody gets out of there, and nobody did. It was an open prison. Not like it's been deadlocked out for many, many years. But I was an old public man. And we almost did the same thing as Attica prisoners do, but it didn't quite come up that way.
Yeah.
And they'll just say, okay, I'm not going to float out this way. So one day on the exercise yard, my friend that I had known in McNeil was transferred there, and he had a stopper, man. We were working out. A concrete truck came in to provide a lining, pour a lining for a fish pond. Backed up in this hole, and wasn't a few minutes later, the truck driver came over to us. And Marion, surrounded by a double chain link fence that they had on my entry, from the town. And this truck backed up to this fish pond. The truck driver went over the phone, and he said, he took my truck. They had knives, and they took my truck. I said, I suppose they could get through that fence, maybe. It was about 100 yards away, heading straight into a gun tower, looking right into a gun tower. And so we told the driver, says, come over here with us. He says, don't hurt me, don't hurt me. I'll never forget this, man. You don't forget this stuff. So we got down in the corner in the concrete building, and they opened up about 50, 60 rounds, I'd estimate. The truck didn't move 10 feet. They flattened the tires, killed the engine, water pouring down, and I was the first one to get over, and I pulled Mike Reynolds out behind the wheel. He shot the forehead, brains all splattered behind. And that was the end of Mike, and we went on strike, and Attica quieted down, and they got slaughtered. And I got out. I got out after 19 months and 10 years. Interrupt me anytime, because I'm back in Portland with my family. I didn't go back to the university like I said I would. I wasn't interested in the PhD anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I had it in me to continue what I was doing. Now, that's, I have a certain amount of regret about maybe that at times, but not too much.
Right.
Not too
much. I just wanted to ask if we could go back just for a second. Can we talk a little bit about kind of the, because I actually didn't know this. I thought the Young Patriots were just basically situated in Chicago. I didn't know that there were chapters in New York and Eugene. Can you talk a little bit about just like kind of, can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
Okay. I was just saying, I didn't know that there were chapters in Eugene and New York. I just thought basically the Young Patriots were based out of Chicago. Can you talk a little bit about the scope of the Young Patriots and just like how many chapters were there? Like how was it organized? And kind of also just tell people what the Young Patriots actually did, because I think people don't really have an idea of the kind of things the Young Patriots actually organized and what they carried out in their communities.
Sure, excuse me. I organized a chapter in Eugene, like I described.
Uh-huh.
That was Eugene and Springfield. That's a divided community. Springfield is a mill town full of Southerners, white working class. So side by side is how that exists. The chapter in New York City was organized by split off group. See, we didn't call ourselves in Eugene the Young Patriots. We called ourselves the Patriot Party. And the Patriot Party, organized by Preacher Man and his wife Darlene, and a New York attorney named Arthur Turkle, who later went on to be a lawyer for the Panther 21. Arthur Turkle invited me to come back east to the Yorkville chapter, which was another Patriot chapter in an urban area. That was a big move for basically a country boy like me. And what did we do there? Well, there were hungry people to feed. There was a Breakfast for Children program that was organized by the Patriots in Yorkville. People called on the elderly and gave them rides as they needed. And there's plenty of old folks in those downtown buildings that never see anybody. So it was a big move to do that. We also began to get complaints about housing problems and plumbing and so forth. So we began to catalog that, and we had an information center there that people could drop into, and also where the police could park every day in a huge bus full of cops right across from our office. And so we had guns, but again, guns aren't really the whole point of all this in some ways. Even the Panthers now understand that it never was that much about guns, but it was about serving the people. So how do we do that? How do we really do that in concrete ways? Well, the Breakfast for Children program went on to become maybe, I don't know how many breakfasts around the country were being served by other individuals and groups and churches and civic organizations says, we can do the same thing. We have hungry kids here, and their parents are going to be happy with us, and that's what happened. About 20,000 breakfasts were being served in those years of 1969 and 70, even while the FBI was coming down so hard on us.
And this is organized by the Patriots. I just want to be clear, not just the Panthers. We're talking about the Patriots were doing this as well.
Okay, the basic underlying attitude was that there was a lot of interest in what the Panthers were doing, as well as the M-Wars and back east more so than down here. But then there was the Brown Berets and there was the American Indian movement. What was all that about, really? Well, it was about going to work for sure, but mainly in your own community. And who are your own people? Because there have been certain lessons learned, I think, by a lot of, especially white folks and black folks around, the Southern movement with draw students, and some of them were very brave, and some of them were workers. And yet, when you went home, what did you do? And the black folks had their own problems, and this is an old story. So Fred Hampton and the Panthers, Bobby Lee in particular, they said, look, the best way is, and there's already guys in uptown Chicago, they're already interested in helping out. And this stuff grows little by little. You don't want to rip off your neighborhood anymore. You don't want to rip off each other anymore. And you want to do some good. And these young gang members that eventually preceded the Young Patriots, the Goodfellows and a couple other, that history is high sermons to tell. But this was how it started. And then, eventually, Bobby Lee came over and lived in uptown for 2 weeks and said, look, this is the best way. You guys can do this yourself. And it was essentially a moment of great understanding on the part of the Young Patriots to say, yes, that they're exactly right. And so the Young Patriots and then the Patriot Party that I formed in Eugene, Oregon, essentially copied the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. And where it said black people, we inserted oppressed white people. So we need freedom. We oppressed white people need freedom. We oppressed white people need a land distribution. And it was, we didn't last long enough to really circulate this, I have to say, by comment. I don't like to say we didn't last because I'm still, and Hi Thurman's still around. And I think that we, what the party was able to do in Eugene and Yorkville was to set an early example of how you can undertake these matters in your own working class community. I live in one now. I live in a very small rural village in eastern Washington, about 300 people. All of my neighbors are in old raggedy trailer houses. They're usually the family houses. Right here. These are my neighbors. And they're people that are they're white people. There's we live between the Spokane and Colville Indian Reservation in this area of Washington State, which is sort of central Washington near the Columbia River. But white people don't have any other choice around here except Donald Trump. There's no Hillary Clinton signs except Hillary Clinton go to prison. And though Bernie Sanders did good in Spokane, I've always felt that I moved here because of a divorce, not necessarily by choice. But this just happened to be really good, inexpensive housing, and I think I very much needed it. I've been here a year now. A young white kid with a young man was gunned down, shot in the back by a deputy sheriff after I moved here. I did some work on reporting on that. Mm-hmm. Been involved in the local school board over issues there. My landlord neighbor is a sovereign citizen, the combat veteran of Vietnam, the same age as me, and Second Amendment rights. I tell you what, having a criminal record doesn't do so bad.
Right.
Because everybody else is so
well. Well, Let's kind of talk about some broader stuff. I'm speaking broadly of the Patriots as a group, but when you would all go into white working class communities and you know, start to organize and especially talk about building solidarity with other communities. Like, can you tell us some experiences about that? Like, because I think most people would assume that, for one, a lot of people would just be like, ah, whatever, like, shit's fucked up and it's always going to be that way. Or two, people are like, you know, well, what do we got to do with, you know, what's happening in, like, the ghetto or, you know, the barrio or something?
Well, that's a good question out here, especially because this is a white network. Hunter in Washington was planted here with the last fighting was done to put the Spokane tribe on their reservation, and then the Colville, the thing, the Colville reservation, the Hancock reservation. But in the school down the block, okay, not a quarter of a mile down the block, it's a very small K through 12 school that has about 25% Indian students. So there's right away this money down here from a very small town in this area. I lived in Colville, Washington for 15 years prior to moving down here. I did a lot of drug war, anti-prohibition work down there. And essentially, my ex-wife and I established a base of rural organizing in Colville that was setting the standard, because we were able to bring together on a variety of issues, including stopping the jail, promoting out-of-town visitors, and bringing in black folks, brown folks, speaking and music and so on. We brought together loggers and hippies and professionals and so on. So I've had a lot of experience in this area alone, which is where I grew up. I didn't mention that I had a lot of experience working with other groups on the inside in prison, because I want to make it clear that this Rainbow Coalition solidarity meant something, and it does mean something. I'm an invited guest along with Mike Berman on the Black Panther Party 50th reunion. It still means something. And so for me in prison, for example, here's one quick story. In the Oregon State Prison in about 1977, I was doing 18 years on some other charges, and it's a long story that I can tell another time, but I ended up with an 18-year sentence, separately from the gun charge. And I was in there, and the warden hated me. He moved me way out to a country jail out in the Indian Reservation, and he moved me around a lot. And so while I was gone, one time, a white prison wife, this young white kid was, I shouldn't say kid, a young white youth who was a political prisoner too, but he didn't have an ability to defend himself physically. He couldn't fight. He didn't have it in him. So while I was gone, a black prisoner raped me. And this black prisoner was notorious, I guess, and so I got back, and one of the Panthers in the dining hall one day in the child line, he said, Chuck, Bill and I didn't like what happened to Jim. We don't approve of that. So we went to him and said, we know you can't really do this, but we'll hold him if you want to stick him. And Jim didn't want to do that. But the trouble is, if you come late, you're in a closed pit, you can't go somewhere else, right? This is what prison's about. You know, you either check in or you do something else. You're in, or you establish the standard that says, I will not be fucked with. And Jim couldn't do that the way that this act of solidarity between two Panther members doing a lot of time and me was representative of kind of the if you think about how long this stuff lasts, it lasted all the way there for me. I think I've been crazy for a lot of people. Not to go to prison to figure that out. But when I was locked up, I asked a friend sometimes to come up to me, occasionally, especially in Marion, and say, how can you want to play basketball with any nigger? Well, what do you have? What's the answer to that? And I said, well, I'm from the West Coast, brother, and I'm a good player, and et cetera. And I said, besides, you guys need to know about the young people. And they sat there and listened to me. And essentially, that kind of carved out a little place for me with my little pinky 10-year sentence.
Well, I'm curious, when you had those interactions with, like, the Klan dudes, like, how did that go about? Like, what was the...
I was sitting at a basketball in the Marion Bleachers watching a basketball game with all black players. I became a really good basketball player a little bit later on when I became in Oregon, especially. I got stronger and better, and I was the white guy playing on the all black team. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very hard. I mean, I played against Millwall Brothers. They came and played, but back in Maryland, there weren't as many anti-racist whites. I was one of the new kind of prisoners that was a sort of a puzzle, but I did have a friend there from Spokane who was a pretty bad white boy. He was a pretty tough athlete, but got in a lot of trouble. Kenny Pendleton is his name, prolific bank robber. And Kenny and I were friends, so there was a little bit of already some friendship basis there. It's good to have a friend or two in there that you know you can look around at, because I didn't know these guys. I didn't know these Klansmen. They had KKK all over their damn arms. And,
yeah.
So I just sat there like a good teacher that I am, and I asked them questions about their lives. What about you? This is what the patriots are doing. You know, what about you? What are you? Shit, they sat there like sentences, man. It wasn't bad. Now, did that happen over and over? Not at your age anymore. I wasn't there that long. People have all kinds of recurring problems that they're interested in. It's obvious, you know. But later on in Oregon and out west, a little more, I had anti-racist boys like Steve Jasper and Dennis Kness in Oregon who had been raised in the system, and they were anti-racist. You know, they would stand up, man. Dennis, Steve Kessler became known as what do they call him? Anyway, he would literally stand off the Nazis with his big knife and daring them to come forward. That's the kind of white brother that Steve was. And he really admired the young preacher. He admired who I was coming in there. I turned my back. I could have made my life much easier, I suppose. You know, I'd be able to say what I would have been. But I didn't have it in me, and I had no regrets. So, 75 next month.
Well, just to kind of, you know, we've been talking for a while, just to kind of, look back on everything, do you have any advice for younger people that are starting to engage in organizing, kind of like we're in this period with Trump, where he's kind of like reaching out to the white working class, you know, and basically pushing this politics of kind of watered down white nationalism? I mean, do you have any kind of lessons or anything you'd like to say just to kind of like, you know, push people in the right direction? Just as far as, you know, if they are white, if they are working class, kind of like ideas they could start to do about organizing?
Well, that's really the most fundamental one, because that's all folks got to lead this to somebody. And yes, I do. I think that the interest shown around the country, and especially just as almost daily for me, is that there's a lot of renewed interest in the young patriots among white populations, and I serve as a testament. I just read emails this morning from the other side of the state on the ocean, where there's been some organizing around homeless issues and the lack of employment and drug abuse in Aberdeen, Washington, and Westmore, and they really want to get a hold of me now. So we're going to talk tomorrow. What are we talking about? Well, the things that really count. In my little community, for example, I've only been here a year, but I can already tell, and this is advice for anybody, is that organizing isn't too difficult, but you have to be able to know and be who's around you. I mean, and figure out in fundamental ways to be a good listener and to sort it out. What does your community need? For example, our little community has a big oxycontin problem. Heroin problem.
Right.
More active little hunters community. And there's only three churches. There's one school district. Again, there's only about 300 people. And there's a bar, there's a senior center. There's a, I just went to the food bank yesterday. But right down the road of the food bank is the major clubhouse. Well, you gotta see, I know that this one church, I'm working on this idea because I think that some of these ideas bear repeating, and just because they're out of the set, people need I have to hear a lot of bullshit from drunk people. I have to hear even my landlord thinks that we ought to nuke the whole Middle East sometimes. And then, you know, turn it into farmland like the coal magnate says around here. You know, we're going to turn it into farmland. I don't think so. But this is truly what, if a person has, you know, the liberal in our, on our sins and a lot of liberal thinking, it's a good subject, but you want to do something in your own community, in your own community, then there has to be a certain sense of, there's a lot of energy for change here. These people can do this themselves, and we have to be able to somehow help them to find how to organize a free health clinic, for example, right in my neighborhood. We don't have anything. There's no doctor here, no dentist, no lawyer. You have to go an hour away to go to a doctor. So I think I can do this, and at the same time, I'm going to be able to be part of it. And I have a lot of experience fighting drugs. I've got 15 years of writing about the drug war. I traveled across the country and spoken out against the war on drugs, the racist war on drugs. And so I think I have a role to play here right now as an older man, and already the younger people, especially the natives and the youth that mingle here, and the clan of the same teams, and they hang out together, and I already know what kids are doing and they shouldn't be doing, and so on. And so, to make it very brief, I think I'm going to be able to convince the Presbyterian Church here, which only has 8 members in it, so let me use their kitchen and their office space, and it's easy access in this very small area. I'm talking about this less than a half a mile from me as I speak. And so this is something I think we can start doing, and from there, you know, this is a people's movement, and the understanding that we are the servants of this energy. No matter how old you are, if you're committed, you're in it anyway. I mean, we're all in it now because of the very nature of how white nationalism has become a huge issue. I mean, I understand why what's in my Trump neighbors, the reason they're going to vote for him is they want to get the big finger, the big middle finger to Clinton.
Right.
There's no option. I mean, unless it's the Jill Stein option. But I've been to a meeting, for example, that the town of Carlville, which is where I was living, near the fairground. I went to a meeting there with Clive and Bundy, who was killed by the FBI or the police in Oregon. The Metal Gear Occupation.
Right.
Yeah. I'm familiar with that.
Yes, and yes.
I went to a memorial service for him. There was a lot of people there, a lot of cowboy hats. And I knew a lot of these people because I had actually lived in that neighborhood. I'm just an old cowboy anyway. Put way back. But I'm at ease with them. And part of it is just being at ease with folks. But I sat there with a friend and I listened to a singer sing a Bob Dylan song. He stood up in front of the cowboy hats and he said, Bob Dylan was one of the greatest revolutionaries of all time. The woman right in front of me has got a big 45 on her head, an open carry state. And this is a crowd that is there to honor Bundy, which is another kind of revolution. They kept talking about revolution. But it was such an interesting mix of Bob Dylan and occasionally acid rock music that he was playing along with that I thought, well, you know, this is something, Gene, because we're straddling these populations that, for the most part, there aren't many people like me out here.
Yeah.
It's a place where people can go. If people want to really get in some training in an old nasty trailer park, there's plenty of places to find poor, white, working class people to align with, to learn from. For example, I spoke at Gonzaga a couple weeks ago, Gonzaga University of Spokane, and I spoke to a crowd of about 80, 90 people. There's two black women there, and I'm the only one with 60. There was a social far from Hamburg. I don't live too far from Churchill Air Base. Clinton decides to launch a war against Russia, which seems pretty likely.
Yeah.
And then you know, we've always been partners for out there. Hamburg is, you know what that is, it's the world's largest superfund site.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if
is that answering your question? Anything lingering in your head?
I mean, there's a lot. We'll have to come back and do another podcast. Chuck, I really thank you for coming on the show with us. And I know we had some problems to begin with, but we got through it. And hey, man, it was great having you on, and it's great to just continue this conversation. I think this is a conversation that we're gonna have to come back to and keep talking about.
I'd love to have it. I really do appreciate this, and I have to say to your viewers, it led me to it in my first Skype adventure. I looked at your website. I'm happy to see that you're covering a lot of the prisoner struggles right now, especially the current work strike, or the strikes around the country. So, right on.
Cool, man. Anything else you want to say in closing?
Well, I can just say that, you know, people get to practice it in their bathroom.
Okay, everybody, thanks for sticking with us to the end of the podcast, and thanks for Chuck from the Young Patriots Party for coming on the show. We really enjoyed it, Chuck. We hope to hear from you soon. If you want to get more from us, check us out online at itsgoingdown.org, on Twitter at IGD_news, on Facebook at itsgoingdown. We have a couple more podcasts that are going to be on the subject of the white working class and kind of pushing through this system of white supremacy and getting to the heart of pushing a really class war politic that unites people of all nationalities and colors under the banner of liberation and collective struggle against capitalism. But if you want to learn more about the Young Patriots Party and the original Rainbow Coalition, we really suggest that you check out a book by James Tracy and Amy Sawney entitled Hillbilly Nationalists, Urban Race Rebels, and Black Power, Community Organizing Radical Times. There's also a really great website that has a lot of good articles, resources, and photographs, and it's youngpatriots/rainbowcoalition.org. And if you search that, Young Patriots Party, Rainbow Coalition, you can find that. And hopefully we'll have one more person from the Young Patriots Party on the program very soon. So stay tuned. We really hope you enjoy this. Really hope you enjoy everything we're putting out. Again, if you can, please, please donate to It's Going Down. Make a monthly donation. Make a one-time donation. Donate to us on Bitcoin, on PayPal, using your credit card or debit card, and please help us continue. Thanks a lot for listening.